Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Fraser Nelson. I'm joined by Kate Andrews, Spectator's economics correspondent, and Stephen Bush of The New Statesman. So, late last night, we had a sudden announcement from Gavin Williamson, the Education Secretary. Students in England will be able to use their mock exams to appeal if they don't get the A-level results they want tomorrow. This follows a fracas in Scotland over the marking down of several Scottish higher results, which led to the government having to do a massive U-turn. So, Stephen, when we saw the Scottish debacle, it was pretty obvious that the same storm was heading towards England. Do you think that's what's changed their mind? It's pretty strange to have a fundamental announcement of what's happening to A-level results announced at sort of 10 o'clock in the evening.
It is. I mean, it's odd because one of the original sort of proposed devolution dividends was that you would get policy experimentation in England, Scotland, and to a lesser extent in Northern Ireland. And this would allow people to follow best practice. And in some ways, right, this is that sort of happening live, which is that it has become clear that politically giving people grades via algorithm is just not a position that governments want to be in. And so I think then what they've done is they've tried to come up with this triple lock that will prevent the kind of political row that erupted in Scotland last week from erupting in England.
Kate, tell us how this triple lock works.
So the triple lock essentially gives a lot of power back to the students. Pupils can go ahead with their mock exam grades, or they can use the moderated grade that they're going to get tomorrow, which is a combination of predicted grades from teachers and also a formula that the government's come up with to try to assess how schools might have performed based on past performance. Or, I think crucially, this is really key, they can choose to sit an exam in autumn. And whichever is the higher mark out of these three options, the student can take. Now, that's rather generous. It means that a lot of students who might have been looking at getting downgraded are actually going to get a significantly higher grade because they can choose between one of these three things. And one of the major complaints over the first half of the week has been that the meritocracy was completely taken out of the process. That if you were a student who perhaps had a disadvantaged background, went to a poor school, worked very hard, you didn't get the opportunity to show what you could do. And I think that the opportunity to actually sit an exam means that any student who says, you know what, I'm better than what's being predicted, I'm better than my school's average, can still go forward and sit that exam. There is still some element of an appeals process here. It hasn't totally empowered the students, but much more so than it did about 12 hours ago. Now, I thought it was interesting that the National Union of Students said that using mock results actually made a mockery of the exam system. And you do have some sympathy for that. Kids who've worked really hard and have earned the grades know that other kids may be getting higher grades that they don't deserve. But the alternative is to potentially be marking down students who should have gotten those higher grades. And I think given the absolute chaos of these past 5 months, given these are totally unprecedented times, to lean in favor of giving students a bit of a boost up, to give them the benefit of the doubt, is probably the right way to go, whether you're in Whitehall or in Holyrood.
Now, Stephen, one of the main concerns about lockdown is that it will have deepened educational inequality. If you're from a relatively wealthy household, you probably have been sitting there in your bedroom all to yourself with your laptop, probably with a Zoom teacher who's in the best state schools and private schools and the grammar schools. It's been quite well documented how they've been a lot more attentive with education than some of the tougher schools that have had less resources and haven't done it as well. So isn't there a problem here that we're just simply papering over the cracks of educational inequality? You can give somebody a better mark than an A-level than they would otherwise have got, but that doesn't really repair the damage. It doesn't fill the gap of education that they will have sustained over the last few months.
The central problem, and I say this is very much hindsight being 2020, because I was very much someone who, when I read on Ofqual's blog, when they set out what they were going to do in the methodology, I thought, oh yeah, that seems very sensible. It was only when it happened that I realised, oh no, this is actually a terrible idea. Because the problem with what all four governments are trying to do is they're essentially going, well, what would have happened if those exams had happened? But whatever results you produce from that process are fraudulent, right? So let's take, say, the example of someone, hardworking, very bright child from a school that hasn't done very well, predicted to get straight A's. Well, bluntly, that person was almost certainly would not get an A if they had to do their exams in the backdrop of what's just happened. Now, actually, the moderation process will probably see that person get straight A anyway, but the sort of big lie that this process kind of has bought into is this idea that we can go, oh, well, this cohort, 69% of them have got passes, or 81% if you use the, I would say, obviously wrong, unmoderated results. But the reality is the very difficult challenge for us as a society is both higher education, further education, and the labour market are going to have to absorb a cohort of people, including some in some cases people who are very bright and very hardworking, who actually don't have the skills we would expect them to have in normal circumstances, who are going to need a bit more support. This is why, you know, for example, the stuff that Rishi Sunak was proposing on apprenticeships is going to be such an important part of how you get out of this problem. But I think you're completely right to say that in some ways, this whole endeavour from the beginning has been about this fiction that you can do something which goes, and that was a normal year in terms of educational outcomes, which it just wasn't.
And Kate, I mean, Stephen mentions the example of a bright kid who would have got an A and who will probably still get one under this process. But there will be lots of other kids who are getting GCSEs who basically would have failed a GCSE. They're going to be given a pass. And now they're going to start Upper Six, not quite realising how much work they will have to do. So isn't there a problem here that in being kind, you actually could end up not giving parents information that they need, teachers information and pupils information that they need to work out who needs the help? Because right now, I'm imagining, by the way, that the wealthiest kids will have done the best during this. But I imagine that there's going to be so many kids starting lower sixth in England, who will not have had the chance of doing a GCSE or a standard grade in Scotland. And I'm not sure if the resources are going to be there to bring them up to speed. They risk never really having that time made up.
I suspect that the resources won't be there, and this is going to be a problem that, if we realise it or not, in this moment, these kids may be living with for the rest of their lives. Norway did a study looking into potential lost income of this student group, or these student groups, I should say, that are going through school right now, and the figures were bleak. We haven't seen any study like this from the UK, and as the Spectator leader says for this week's magazine, it's becoming increasingly clear that by giving students this pass, if you will, by giving them this boost, the government's going to be able to brush a lot of things under the rug, say, well, actually, look, everyone's well, everyone's fine, we don't have a problem here, when obviously we do. But Fraser, I think the only way that this will come to light is with time. If children who get through their GCSEs, get that boosted grade, go into their A levels and aren't performing as they should, we're only going to know that when they're back at school with their teachers, and that communication between teacher and student, between teacher and parent, is back up and running. And, you know, sound like a broken record, but once again, it is just so imperative that schools open in September, because we can't make these assessments now when kids are still so far away from their learning environments.
So Stephen, you've got, as Kate's outlining here, the plight of the poorer student who's just been shortchanged by the school, who has had their problem covered up by the government. Surely this is a classic area for the Labour Party to champion. So Keir Starmer ought to be able to come here and saying, look, you can give out as many A's and B's as you like, but there are millions of kids here who have just been denied a proper education. So might this, I'm trying to work out, because so far Labour have kind of been all over the place in school closures, not quite sure if they're for them or against them. And as a result, haven't really held the government to account on the widening educational inequality and the need to close this inequality. So do you think we might be able to see a strong counterattack from Keir Starmer, or is the Labour Party simply in a different place?
So I don't think that we will see a particularly strong counter for a couple of reasons. One, as you say, they have never had a particularly coherent position on school reopening and, you know, whether or not they're for it or indeed. Now, obviously, Keir Starmer has done a very good job introducing himself personally, if the polls are to be believed. But I think that the thing Labour has got wrong in terms of how it's done opposition in this period is that they've been very reluctant to make big calls of their own, right? So my essential view is that the consequence of school closures are so much worse than anything else and so much harder to fix than if the way you can open schools without self-distancing is to shut people like me in a cupboard. Yes, I don't have any children. I obviously, I wouldn't enjoy being shut in a cupboard for the whole of the school term, but, you know, I would cope. If the way you can get schools back is to shut people like me in our cupboards for that period of time, you should do it. Now, if the Labour Party had that type of position, then you can see how they would be able to have a sort of meaningful dividing line with the Conservatives on this. But they're kind of in the same kind of muddy position the government's in of, oh, we'd like schools to go back, but we're not really willing to upset anyone too much to get that to happen. Whenever you ask them, well, what about the Welsh Labour Liberal Democrat coalition government, they just look panicked. Even when they've actually got a positive story to tell, they looked panicked. And I think, you know, so that they don't have a line to take on, well, why aren't schools open in Wales? Does Wales show you would do anything differently? They haven't made any big and controversial calls about how they would reopen schools, which I just think means that they can only look opportunistic, because up until the point that he kind of put some chips on the table and go, here's my position, I'm willing to be attacked for it, people will always go, well, there are many, many criticisms I personally have of the government's approach, but it's an approach. So, yeah, I think that he's not well-placed to fire back on this one.
Meanwhile, Kate, we had a verdict today on the government's approach to lockdown. GDP figures for the second quarter of this year, effectively these are figures for April, because the economy returned to growth in May and June. But in April, 20% decrease, giving us one of the worst Q2 figures in the whole of Europe.
Yes, it's strange to talk about headlines that read we are officially in recession, because if you have been living the lockdown life for the past few months, you knew that we were in recession. You couldn't go to the shops, you couldn't get your hair cut, you couldn't get a cup of coffee for months. It was very clear that something was not right. And unsurprisingly, if you do a national lockdown of many, many sectors of your economy, you're going to be in economic freefall. And that's what we've seen today. Our economy has contracted in the second quarter 20.4%. Although, as you say, Fraser, it's interesting because that huge drop did come in April. In May, we've seen an uptick of 2.4%, and then in June, close to 9%. Now, that is encouraging because remember what happened in June. The government reopened non-essential shops, and that would suggest that that really did have a meaningful impact. People picked up their economic activity. Hopefully, next month, when we get the July figures, when pubs reopen, in restaurants, hairdressers, far more, we'll see an even bigger economic boom. But by no means should we say that this uptick that we're seeing now guarantees a V-shaped recovery. There's so many more questions. What will happen with these local lockdowns? Will the government really shut down London? If you shut down London and Manchester, you might as well be back in some kind of national lockdown for England at least. That's 25% of the economy. Will sectors in the arts and entertainment be able to further open up? Because a lot of the gains that we're going to get in GDP are actually for sectors that are still in very heavy lockdown. And I suppose the last thing I say, Fraser, is you're right. The UK could well be on track to having the hardest hit economy in Europe this year. All Western countries have experienced some kind of recession. This has not been a great time for anyone. But a lot of countries look like the much better ones in a bad bunch. This is not a race that the UK wants to lose.
So, Stephen, that means we'd end up with a Tory COVID response leading to the worst COVID death toll in Europe, the worst economic hit in Europe. So surely opportunities shouldn't get much bigger for the Labour Party. We've had Nicola Sturgeon up in Scotland making huge capital on competence. She hasn't handled the crisis much better, but she at least hasn't made promises she's had to retract. So by standing in contrast to the tragicomedy going on in Westminster, she's managed to gain a lot of political capital, which the Labour Party doesn't seem to have done so far, because despite all of this, the Tories are still ahead in the polls. So at what point can Keir Starmer start to say to the public, surely I would handle this better, surely it's time to think about supporting Labour rather than the Conservatives?
Yeah, and I think the Sturgeon point is very well made, because she is very much doing the same thing the Labour Party in England wants to do, which is, OK, she's obviously still talking about independence in a kind of very sort of quiet voice, but what she's essentially doing is going, I'm competent, they're incompetent, never mind the values divide, this is just about who you think is good at running Scotland, which is very much where Labour wants to be. They're going, look, OK, all of that culture war stuff, it's very tiresome, aren't we more competent? Now, of course, it may be that we're kind of still in the phony war stage of this recession, right? The data is bad, but the lived experience for most people as yet is not. So it may be then, you know, kind of we'll look back and go, gosh, do you remember that period before Labour had a large lead? But I do think it speaks to, again, that problem that the Labour Party has not made many big calls on how it would do things differently. Now, in some ways, that's kind of the reverse of what Nicola Sturgeon has done, right? What have the actual differences been? They've mostly been very small, but she's done a very good job of instrumentalising those big differences and kind of demonstrating how she would have run things differently. Whereas it's not yet clear, beyond, you know, having like tidier hair, how Keir Starmer would actually have dealt differently with any of these big calls other than he would have sacked Dominic Cummings, which is, you know, I mean, great, but it's not, you know, the dividing line on which elections are won and lost. I find it hard to see, obviously, with the massive disclaimer that when the furlough ends, that will be a moment of incredible pain for millions of people in this country. I find it hard to see how Labour will be able to get that lead they want on competence when they're not setting out, even in broad strokes, how their approach to exit from lockdown would be different.
Stephen and Kate, thanks very much indeed. You can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, on the iTunes store or to the magazine itself. We've got a ridiculously generous offer right now, which I ought not to be promoting really, but you can get a £20 Amazon voucher if you pay £12 for a trial subscription of The Spectator. You can do the maths, it doesn't add up. That can be found at spectator.co.uk/voucher. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks to our producer, Cindy Yu.